Welcome to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. I am Dr. John, the guide for your heroic journey towards greater health, success, and most importantly, happiness. And now, on with the show.
Hi, this is Dr. John, and I am thrilled to announce that Jory and I are opening up our retreat in beautiful Costa Rica from September 28th of 2024 to October 5th. Everyone wants fulfilling relationships. The hard part is love is not enough. So many factors can get in the way, preventing ongoing connection, intimacy, and aligned growth. All healthy relationships start within. But when we have unresolved stuff, it can easily interfere with those we are seeking to be closest with. Whether you're in a long-term committed partnership or are single and are looking for love, this retreat will guide you in the heroic journey of healing yourself so that you can be open and available to cultivate the fulfilling relationships you desire and deserve. To find out more, visit joriroese.com/retreats. That's joriroese.com/retreats. Hey, everybody. This is Dr. John with the Evolved Caveman Podcast, and it is my pleasure to be here with my beautiful fiance, Jory Rose.
Hey, everyone. We are excited to be coming together for another joint episode on both of our podcasts. As not only a continuation of some of the stories that we've been wanting to share with you all, but also in bringing all of our work that we've done personally over the past year, or really the past 8 years of our relationship, combined with our entire careers, some of the ways that we are having some new offers that are going to be available to be able to work with all of you who are wanting a more connected relationship. So stay tuned to the end of the episode so you be sure to hear what those are. But John, you want to get us started of our topic today, which is all about connection.
Sure. And we thought we would start off with a little bit of stories about our trip to Africa, because that trip was pretty profound in terms of pointing out the power of connection. And, you know, I think the difference was between a collectivist culture, which it is in the East and in Africa, versus our individualistic or hyper-individualistic culture in the United States of America. And here in America, we all seem to be out for number one. We're all out for ourselves. And there, it was markedly different. The people we ran into everywhere in three different countries seemed to be, for the most part, generous, warm, caring, kind. And there was, I don't know, I'm drawing a blank there.
There was a tangible experience of recognizing it was about the other.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been saying we went to Africa for the animals as one goes on safari. Like, that's why we made the big long trek to get there. But what we really got out of the experience was the people.
Yeah. Well, and just this idea that of enlightened self-interest, right? That they seem to understand better than we do this idea that if I help you, if I help my neighbor, if I help my friend, I'm helping myself in turn. Or if I help my partner, my romantic partner.
Yeah.
So help me help you kind of idea. And that just, I've never been in a place where that idea hit me so hard.
Yeah, it was powerful for both of us, and it kept happening. It wasn't a one and done. So one of our favorite experiences was actually something that we both were a little anxious to do when we saw it on the itinerary, which was to go to Kibera, which was in Kenya, and it's the biggest slum in Nairobi. And 1.2 million people in a square mile, which you and I couldn't even fathom before we got there what that was like, and had, I think, some assumptions and judgments on what that would have been like for the people who lived there. And what we found was the people were so friendly. I mean, I remember we were walking down the street and there was this guy walking kind of upstream of our group. And he was an older gentleman, and he just was shaking hands, patting everyone on the shoulder, welcoming, you know, saying hello in Kiswahili. And it was just the welcoming of just these outsiders that clearly we were as this tourist group visiting this slum. And the people were just incredible. You know, I had an assumption that they would be depressed and kind of resentful of us Westerners coming in and looking at their way of life, but that was not our experience whatsoever.
Yeah, and just to paint a picture, there's the corrugated or the kind of wavy metal walls, and the people are living in 8x8 houses. And there's no running water, there's no plumbing. There are porta potties, so people would pay for the privilege to use the bathroom. All the water is carried in by hand. They do have cell phones because that's the way most of their economy runs. Right. But it's a fully functioning city. And the whole thing was pretty mind blowing.
Yeah.
And I was even our local tour guide was, his name was David, and he took us into his neighborhood, and there were 2 and 3 year old kids around, and the older kids were off at school. And so we got to, you know, interact with these beautiful young kids. And one of them came up to me and kind of pointed at a water bottle I was holding, and water's a precious commodity there. And so I looked at David and I said, "Hey, can I give him my water bottle?" And he said, "Yeah, sure." He said, "That's my grandson." And I was like, "Okay." And so I gave it to him, and he got a big smile on him. And then he, you know, took a swig of it, and then he was kind of carrying it around under his arm. And then we went to do some in-home visits and talk with some of the people that lived there and hear their stories.
Yeah. And you and I went into separate homes, and the home that I went into was a 23-year-old singer mom with a 15-month-old baby. And I just loved the kids. I just wanted to scoop them all up and just was having so much fun hugging all of them and interacting with them. And so a handful of these young kids came into the quote home that I was in, and there was maybe 4 or 5 little ones. And then this little boy with the water bottle joined in, and I was absolutely amazed. And I actually got a photo of this every single time it happened. But he went to each little kid and poured water into each of their mouths, including the baby who was sitting in my lap. And I was absolutely floored that here is this young little African toddler who has one of the most prized possessions he could have gotten his hands on, and he shared it. Like, what American toddler would share anything, let alone the most prized?
And no one asked him, no one told him.
No.
That was his idea.
It was his idea. And I love that I got pictures of this because I could see the care in which he poured it into each kid's mouth. He didn't hand them the water bottle. He's like, he still was in charge of holding it. But it was such care of, let me share with you what I have. And then you heard a similar story of what the mother of the home that you went into.
Yeah, her husband was a drug addict and abusive. And so she fled with her two kids and had a teenage daughter and a younger boy. And the three of them lived in an 8x8 small little house, if you can call it that. And there was a sheet that split the room in two. And, you know, she would work odd jobs. And sometimes she had money, sometimes she didn't. And we were asking what happens when there's no money. And she said, "Well, when there's no money, there's no food." And we said, "What happens when there's no food?" And she said, "Well, I'm very fortunate because we share here. So if she has food across the way, she shares with me. If I have food, I share with her." So very collectivist, community-minded mindset.
Yeah. So that was really our first introduction to the community that we got to experience in Africa, aside just from the kindness that people we saw in South Africa and the generosity that we experienced there. But when we were in Kenya and Tanzania, we got to go to 3 different villages and experience the village life as well as visit a school. And the same theme was carried on. Mm-hmm. And it was continually remarkable of the way in which the other was as important as self. Mm-hmm. And kind of, I'm jumping ahead and we'll come back to it, but that doesn't tend to be the way that I see in most couples we work with. Mm-hmm. It's not about the other. It's so much about self and defending my position, my belief system, my actions with
looking
less
out for my needs.
Right, with less regard for the other.
Mm-hmm.
And yet when we tend to the other, it strengthens both sides.
Yeah, enlightened self-interest.
Yeah. This power of connection kept coming up for me. There was my absolute favorite day that we had. We got to visit two tribes in one day. And do you want to share about the Hadzabi?
Yeah, so we were in Tanzania and we were, as I kind of joke, we were an hour and a half already in the middle of nowhere. And we had to drive an hour and a half more in the middle of nowhere, off-road, through dried riverbeds. And we finally get to our destination. And the Hadzabi live as they did thousands of years ago. They're hunter-gatherers. They live as nomads. They live in stick huts that they build, or they live in hollowed-out baobab trees with an animal skin on the floor. And they were funny, charming, charismatic, a kick in the pants. They were a blast.
Communicative, even though there was no common language. They speak the Click language.
Mm-hmm.
They wear animal skins. They hunt with bow and arrow. I mean, it was zero evolution to the outside world.
Yeah, they can make every sound of every animal that they hunt or that's around them. And their language is part pantomime, I think. So it's mm-hmm. they act out the animal that they're talking about, which was great fun.
It was an amazing day, amazing experience. And they leave their dead bodies out for the hyenas. They consider hyenas ancestors because that's the only animal that eats bones. And to get to have such an intimate look into their life and their day to day and to see the little kids playing and to get to hear from the chief and how they go about trade with one of the other tribes who we ended up seeing. It was an amazing experience as they live in this community.
Well, and to be able to sing and dance with all these tribes, that was really special to me too.
Yeah.
The first time I was kind of uncomfortable. By the third time it was really moving.
You were there jumping up as high as you could.
Yeah, that was with the Maasai and that was exhausting actually.
Yeah, it's hard. But one of the things, aside from getting such a very unique experience into the Hadzabi, not many people get to experience, going to a Maasai village, I think is a lot more common for people who go visit Africa, but the Hadzabi is something just like in Kibera, not many tourist groups are going to get the opportunity to do. Mm-hmm. And that in and of itself was incredible, but this was a couple of days after the war in Israel had started. And I was pretty distraught, during that time. And there was a lot of emotion I was experiencing. And here we are with the Hadzabi again in the middle of nowhere, from already the middle of nowhere. And we're in the final dancing circle as they are about to send us on our way. And it was the only time that there were other people on our little tour group location that weren't part of our group. And I saw these two women who were part of this dancing and singing circle. And after we were done, before we left, I went up to them and I already knew the answer, but I said, "Where are you from?" And they said, "Israel." And I started to cry and I said, "Can I give you a hug?" And they started to cry and they said, "No one here knows what's happening." And literally we were in the middle of nowhere and I made this connection, partly because I had the courage to speak up and to go talk to a stranger and make this connection. And it was profoundly comforting to me because the words that they were saying to me, and I am imagining that my acknowledgement of their experience and pain was profoundly comforting to them. And it was just like, wow, I could have missed that opportunity to connect by just not speaking up. And later on that day, we visited another tribe that is the blacksmiths, and they make amazing work out of pieces of motorcycles,
discarded metal.
Yeah. Or, arrowheads from just a nail. So it was just amazing what we got to experience. And then that afternoon, we were back at our lodge and we're at the little snack table during, kind of the happy hour. And I just started chatting with this woman who was standing at the table. And I said, "Oh, where are you from?" And when we narrowed down America, California, Northern California, turns out she lives literally a mile from where I live. And it was just hours after connecting with the Israelis. And again, the idea of the power of connection. Here we are. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, I love to talk to people. I'm fascinated by people. I'm curious about people. I want to connect. And how often are we missing those opportunities to connect just because we don't speak up?
When I remember we were at the hotel the last day of our trip, like right before we left for the airport, and we were sitting out by the pool, and there was a guy there that was coaching like one swimmer at a time in a little hotel pool. Like it wasn't even 25 yards. And yeah. I grew up swimming, so it always catches my attention. And so I was talking to one of the swimmers and he was really kind. And then later I talked to the coach and I said, hey, you know, it looks like you're coaching some swimmers here. And he was like, yeah. And so he told me that he was competed in the Olympics in the 50 meter free and was the first swimmer to represent Tanzania in the Olympics. And he actually sits on the International Olympic Committee. I was like, holy smokes, that's amazing. And, you know, those kind of connections, those stories, they make the world go round. Like they light me up.
Me too.
And I think both people, like when you make a connection, both of you walk away with a small or larger positive emotional boost. And I think that, you know, COVID really pointed out how much we miss that for many of us, but I still know there's a lot of people out there that overlook connection, I think largely because of their primal world beliefs around people in general. You know, are they trustworthy? Are they good? Are they going to take advantage of me? Are they going to hurt me? Those kind of things.
Right. Well, and what was hilarious about that swim coach was not knowing the context, he kind of was a hard ass. And we thought, wow, this guy's kind of being an ass to this little kid in the pool. And then once we had the context of, no, he was a coach and had, you know, had this high degree of expertise in his field. Yeah. It was like, oh, so it also helps us get rid of judgments when we understand people and are curious.
Well, first
about
I thought it was
people.
A father coaching his son. And I was like, wow, that's kind of harsh.
He was,
you know, he had sets that he was doing with the kids. And I was like, that's a lot.
Yeah.
So it does do away with the narratives in our head when we check them out.
Yeah. One of my other favorite, I know you always laugh when I tell this story, but I do love this story because it again about connection and having the courage to speak up. But when we were in the Serengeti and watching a couple of lions eat a Cape buffalo, there weren't that many Jeeps around us. There were only our two Jeeps and two others. And the one in front of us was from the Four Seasons. And the three people in that Jeep were standing up watching the lions eat the Cape buffalo and drinking champagne. And I was like, dude, I'm on the wrong safari. Like, where's my champagne? And I was joking, kinda, but I said to the girl, I said, hey, you guys got any extra champagne? And she actually said, yeah, we've got a bottle of rosé. Do you want it? And I said, yeah, that'd be awesome. Thanks. And she literally climbed up on top of her Jeep, 5 feet away from the lions, and handed us this $70 bottle of champagne. And A, it makes for a great story.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And now she gets to go home and tell her side of that story, which I'm sure made her feel really good knowing she made our day because we got to have this awesome bottle of champagne with our shitty bag lunch. Right. And no one else in our group wanted it. So we got to have it. And, you know, we paid the driver on our way out, but it was also the reminder of the courage to speak up. Like you never know mm-hmm. what you're missing by not having the courage to speak up. And I wasn't just wanting champagne. I just liked the conversation of, oh, how awesome you're going to drink champagne while doing this.
And there's another story I think we have to share just because it's funny. It doesn't really have to do with connection. But when we were in Tanzania prior to the Serengeti, and you left the back door open by mistake.
I didn't leave it open. I just didn't lock the back door of our tent and it was windy out.
Right.
And there were a lot of vervet monkeys
all over the place. And they're super cute, but they're kind of annoying. They're in everything.
They're
and so we come back, we went to the pool for a little bit to play cards. And then we had come back and the door was wide open. And we're like, oh shit.
Literally. Well, the context of that story too, just to kind of make the full story, you know, unfortunately John had gotten sick on the plane
first and only time I've thrown up on a plane.
And so he had actually taken some of the barf bags with him just in case. So insurance. The door is open. Yeah, the door is open. And I'm like, oh my God, are there any animals in our room? And I look around, the room seemed to be intact. And then I noticed on the
desk. And then you were on the phone. You're on the phone.
I was talking to my daughter, with my daughter who was in college. Wisconsin. And while FaceTiming her, I look down and on top of the barf bag that you had brought off the plane, a monkey had shit on the barf bag.
Yeah, it was standing up like the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
And I'm screaming, oh my God, a monkey shit in our room. And my daughter on FaceTime is a Hillel, like a Jewish, you know, organization on campus. And people around her are, including the rabbi, are hearing her on the phone with me, hearing me scream, a monkey shit in the room.
I think they're hearing like, you. Yeah.
Right. And you know, she's kind of pointing at the phone to everyone around her, like, my mom's in Africa.
And so you were like, get rid of it. And I was like, okay. And so I pick up the bag and the shit and I go to the garbage can, which has a handle and a lid. So I step on the little handle, the foot handle, and throw it in the garbage can. There's the close lid. And then I come back out and you're like, what did you do with it? And I was like, I threw it in the garbage can. You threw shit in the garbage can. What are you doing? Put it in the toilet. And I was like, okay. So I went and picked it up and I put it in the toilet and I flushed the toilet. And like, wait, did you get a photo of it? I'm like, well, if you put your arm down the toilet, I think you can still catch it. It was pretty funny.
It was hilarious.
It was a little bit of heightened emotion then.
It was, but I mean, you know, make for a good story. Uh-huh. And we had incredible stories with the animals. I mean, our final campsite in the Serengeti was an open space where the zebras were 10 feet from us. We saw cape buffalo in the distance, or wildebeest in the distance. Yeah. There were baboons. We could hear the lions and hyenas. We heard elephants. And then the very last night, there were two humongous cape buffalo, like 5 feet from the back of our tent.
Yeah. And keep in mind, for those listening, it's a tent.
Yeah.
Which does not provide a whole lot of protection against cape buffalo, lions,
hyenas.
It's there's a lot of trust going on there.
Yeah. And the trip was incredible. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't even know that it was a bucket list item for me. And yet again, what I got out of it was so much more than the animals. One of my favorite experiences was doing a sunrise hot air balloon game drive, yeah, which was incredible. Epic. And again, connection, you know, getting curious. You and I are always curious about people's stories. Mm-hmm. And our hot air balloon pilot came from nothing and wanted to be a pilot and didn't really know how he was going to get there. Never even flew in an airplane. And through a series of happenstance, ended up being offered to be a hot air balloon pilot and was sent to Napa for 6 months. And we're like, we live right near there.
Yeah.
And just hearing his story and it reiterates what we got. Our biggest takeaway was the power of connection and having curiosity about people. Yeah. And it's always, we have this whenever we travel.
And I think part of it is having the courage to speak up too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And sometimes you get a bottle of champagne out of it.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that was amazing about that hot air balloon ride was he would dip us down really low, like 10 feet off the ground into like a dazzle of zebra or a herd of cape buffalo. And that was pretty epic.
We were right above them. Yeah, it was incredible. And we always get a reverse culture shock whenever we travel, because we always are seeking to make connection. I mean, we were in France years ago and met an incredible woman who had just been on Oprah. Her story of growing up in Morocco, and she gave us her number. You know, I mean, another time in Paris, I was asking for a bite of someone's food. So I guess there's a theme there about me, but we ended up having a connection and having this amazing night with these people. And so how does it translate back to relationship? And well, I see a lot of connection to connection and relationship.
Yeah. And I think one of the biggest complaints we hear in relationship is I'm disconnected from my partner. Usually it's the wife complaining I'm disconnected from my husband. I can't, there's no connection. And I think that part of it is we get complacent. Mm-hmm. And part of it is we no longer are curious about our partner, mm-hmm. and we stop asking questions and inquiring and looking mm-hmm. for ways that they've grown. Part of it is that we stop showing appreciation and gratitude
yeah.
for the little things that our partner is doing.
Yeah. This is something I think you and I are really good about, is not in our own relationship, is not making assumptions of how are you feeling. We're always asking questions mm-hmm. to each other. And in doing the couples work that I've done in my career and the work that you and I are doing together, couples don't take the time just to ask questions. Or if they do, they assume the answer, or they're not really listening on a more open, deeper level. And, you know, I especially see this come up against points of transition in relationships, like maybe just mm-hmm. having had a baby, and that changes a person.
Or kids leaving the house.
Right. So, you know, different transition points, or a new career, or a family member dying, like all of these life experiences are going to impact how we see the world. They're going to impact our, perhaps even shift our values, shift how we want to spend our time and money and our weekends, or what we're needing out of our partner at different life stages. And we don't see couples asking each other a lot of questions.
Yeah. One of the other things that I see that I think we do quite well is allowing room for one another's emotions.
Yeah.
And I think we've gotten really good. And I think this took a little bit of practice and work, but not judging each other's emotions and just allowing for them.
Yeah.
And it's unlike anything I've experienced in a relationship before.
Well, and I told you that early on. If you guys have heard any of our joint episodes in the past, then, you know, part of our story was about, I don't know, maybe three and a half months into dating. John was over my house one night and was just in an off mood. And as he was leaving, he apologized for, you know, hey, sorry, honey, just in an off mood. It's nothing to do with you. And I said to him, that's totally okay. I accept all of you. And if you're in an off mood or irritable or whatever it is, like, thank you for letting me know it's not me. And I accept all of you, and your mouth just dropped open. But
yeah,
I think it took
a while for me to believe that.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it took time for you to actually truly understand that it was okay. And I think now more than ever, you have great confidence when I say that mm-hmm. I actually have meant that. But it also, on the flip side, it did take me time to realize it wasn't me, even when you said it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And that was my own narrative of before us, of either assuming or it was true, where I was not accepted for who I was. And so it was easy for me to believe, if you were irritable, well, then it must be about me. So it took time for both of us to trust and honor each other's truth is, hey, and even if it was about me, then having the skills to talk about it effectively, repair about it, and come back to a place of safety and harmony into which I didn't have that disconnect anymore. But that's a really big one.
Yeah. And one of the things you wanted to talk about, I'm aware of time, so I wanted to hit on this, was kind of revisiting areas of contention or disagreement when one partner is not exactly reconciled or is still thinking about it or still feeling it.
Yeah. This was a big one for us. I like to talk, and you had limited desire to go into depth as often as sometimes I wanted to. And if we had had a disconnect and we talked about it and it appeared to be resolved, let's say a day or even a week later, if I didn't feel resolved in it and brought it back to you and said, hey, love, I'm not feeling like this is resolved, I still feel disconnected, at first you would get defensive and would be like, hey, I thought we dealt with this. Like, why are we talking about this again? We already talked about it. Aren't you over this by now?
It was hard. At first, I think I was exasperated. You know, I got the eye roll going. I was like, shit, like, we talked about this already.
Yeah. And what we've come to truly realize is if one person's disconnected, the relationship is disconnected. Mm-hmm. And this is a very relational stance to see the you, the me, and the us.
And I think this is the way that we have to deal, that people in general have to deal with these disconnects a lot of the time, because one conversation isn't going to be adequate to address it. Because oftentimes there's stuff that still comes up, thoughts or feelings. And so if you
can trigger
to
right.
this idea that it's an upward spiral where you keep occasionally hitting the same disagreement or topic, but every time you do it, as you get further away from it, you can speak about it with greater curiosity and objectivity until you finally get to the point where you put it to rest and can really look at what are some of the triggers here? What are some of the patterns? Is this really about us? Is this about a prior relationship, or is it about our childhood?
Right. And that was something that I am very curious about. And I talk a lot about this with my clients, are what are the details versus what are the patterns? The details are going to be what's arising week to week, day to day. It's the minutia of the daily transactional conversations or the disconnects. Those are just the details. But I'm really curious of what are the underlying repetitive patterns that are going unresolved? Because if we can attend to the patterns, that's where change occurs. That's where the deep insight, the curiosity, and the healing mm-hmm. is able to come from when we get past the details. But so many couples are stuck in transactional loops. And by transactional, the majority of couples I work with are only having conversations around the kids, the house, the schedule, the bills. It's nothing interpersonal. It's nothing relational. And it becomes such a habit and a pattern that couples don't even know how to begin to get out of that transactional conversation style. And we had an experience a couple of weeks ago. We were away for the weekend and we woke up early and started our morning out. And was it like 6 a.m.? We were up for the sunrise and we just sat. We were at an Airbnb. It was like all windows facing the lake. So we had a really beautiful morning just watching the sunrise, but neither one of us were on our phones. We weren't reading anything. It was too dark. And I think it was about 2.5 hours of our morning where we were just talking. And then our day started, we went out for breakfast and then we came back and we actually spent, I know this sounds strange for you guys listening. We literally spent the next 10 hours talking and we realized like, wow, we've literally spent the entire day talking. And it wasn't because there was things to work through. There weren't arguments. It was true depth of conversation. And I know that's not normal for many couples. And I know maybe even that's not aspirational for a couple to talk that much. But I am having a hard time getting a lot of couples to just talk for 10 minutes once a week.
Or make eye contact for a minute.
It's so vulnerable. So why is it that couples are having such a hard time connecting with their partners when they say, you're the most important person in my life. You're the one I want to be most connected to. And there's a lot of barriers to deeper connection.
Yeah.
It's easier said than done. And I see a lot of those barriers as ongoing unresolved hurt and pain mm-hmm. that causes these rifts in the safety and trust and foundation of the partnership.
Well, and dovetailing on that is defensive listening. So, you know, you bring up something that I did wrong, I get defensive and respond with irritation or anger, and it shuts down the conversation. And then over time, it trains the partner to not bring it up, because why would I bring it up? Because they're just going to get upset with me and nothing's going to change. So you get
demoralized. You've become so good at non-defensive listening that I just want to let people know that those habits can change, because you were, and I think we both were, I didn't recognize it as much in myself.
A little defensive when we started out.
We were, and you had brought the language to me of thank you for sharing. And even if I come to you with anger or frustration, it is quite a matter of really evolved emotional self-regulation to not react, to not get defensive, but to give me the space to express myself, and to be able to honor my needing to express myself, I say, thank you for sharing.
Well, yeah. And I also know it's important for you to get in touch with your anger because you haven't been historically that in touch with your anger. And I can, it's funny because even when I say that, I know that there's some people out there who's, let's say their wives, because that's the direction we're talking about this in, the wives are really comfortable with their anger. And so if I were in a relationship with someone that's always getting angry at me, I don't think I would be saying, thank you for sharing your anger with me quite so easily. So I think it's a little bit situational.
Sure. And I do think there's still space of saying, thanks for letting me know how you feel. Right. Yes. And that's something
that I can see that you're quite angry about this.
Right. Acknowledging the anger is real, valid, and true versus just shutting it down because there's emotion underneath that that clearly is needing to be expressed.
Yeah. And that's a big part too, just validating the emotion.
Yeah.
You know, just speaking to the emotion rather than to the rational intellectual piece.
Right.
Like it's not about the dishwasher.
Right.
It's about, you know, wow, I can see that you feel really hurt that I didn't put the dishes away like I said I was going to. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. There's always a great dishwasher example in every relational thing that we talk about. Mm-hmm. And the key here is how can we turn towards our partners with greater relational attention? And I'm going to share something you said to me the other night. You, at the end of the day, said you had been thinking and you're like, you know, men need to learn to be more relational. Mm-hmm. Can you share what was coming up for you as you were thinking about either what prevents them from being more relational?
Yeah, hold on. I think I got the quote here, which, because this really kind of smacked me in the face. I was doing some research on Carol Gilligan because I wanted to find out more about how women were socialized to go along with the man box that I talk about and how men are socialized. But the quote was from Stanford, and it says, Gilligan's research follows Nancy Chodorow's in suggesting that for boys and men, separation and individuation are critically tied to gender identity. Okay. Further, the development of masculinity typically involves valuing autonomy, rights, disconnection from others, and independence, while seeing other persons and intimate relationships as dangers or obstacles to pursuing those values. Let me repeat that.
I was just going to say, can you repeat that?
Other persons and intimate relationships as dangers or obstacles to pursuing those core values.
Those core values being individuation.
Valuing autonomy, rights, disconnection from others, independence, the very way in which we're socialized as these are the most important things men are supposed to pursue also encourages us to stay away from relationship. It's okay. It's lukewarm. It's don't even go in that direction. And we police ourselves. So men will mock and humiliate each other for being too relational. And think, you know, I can see this very clearly, like in high school, where your guy friends would rib you about being pussy whipped, for example. Like that's super, that was really common back in the day. And so we police ourselves to not want to learn in that direction of how do I get better at communication? How do I get better at being a good boyfriend? How do I get better at being a relationship? How do I turn towards? How do I get more empathy? How do I get more sympathy? How do I get more emotional awareness?
Yeah.
Instead, it's don't be a pussy or don't be gay. That's what we get. Right. Those are the two ends of the man box.
The emotional spectrum that they're allowed to express. Yeah, it's wild. And it literally says in that quote, disconnection, right? So the socialization of masculinity is disconnection from other. And then I'm not putting this all on men, right? So if you're listening out there, the disconnection in relationship is not all the man's fault. But what we're saying is the socialization tends towards more disconnection. And now we wonder, why are so many people in relationship unhappy?
Well, one of the big values in the man box is self-reliance. So we're not supposed to ask for help. We're not supposed to need anybody else. We're supposed to be an island. A rock. And then we get in relationship and we wonder why our wife is upset with us because we can't connect. And then the thing I love about the idea, and I've said this many times before, is men, it's not our fault. We didn't ask to be socialized like this. And I think that's really critical. However, it is our responsibility to evolve beyond it. which is why my podcast is The Evolved Caveman.
Right. So, John, I'm going to ask you a very personal question. In that example of what you just named of not needing others and to be reliant, share what your experience has been over the past 6 weeks of your grieving regarding asking and receiving help, and how that has been counter to that prior paradigm.
I think it's been a practice of mine for the past several years to ask for and receive help, to be better about it. I knew that it was something I really struggled with. And you know, I'm trying to undo 50-year-old patterns. And so I knew it was going to take a little bit of time. But then when my son died, I also knew that I didn't want to handle this like a typical man and bury it and suppress it and deal with it on my own. And so, you know, I did a few things. One, I let you in as deeply as I've ever let you in. You saw it all the emotion, all the grieving, all the suffering and sobbing. But then I also was very honest and transparent with just about everyone else. Most of my clients, I put it out on Facebook.
We did a podcast about it.
We did a podcast about it 2 weeks after it happened, which was, I thought, quite courageous. I think it's one of the bravest things I've ever done.
I've had people say they've listened to that episode multiple times because it has touched so many people. Like I've had, it was courageous and it had,
I don't know
impact.
Why people would listen to it personally, but I'm glad they find purpose in it. And I think, you know, there's some reasons for that. Number one, I didn't want to be self-reliant. I didn't want to be an island. I knew I'd been socialized in that way. I knew it wasn't healthy. I wanted to be able to ask for and receive help and support. And I also wanted to model what it's like to be a masculine man who feels things deeply in this day and age. And I wanted to give permission to the community of men that are around me to feel themselves. That's not masturbation. to feel whatever it is they're feeling. We'd be very clear there, because I know you guys think
in their emotions, not in their hands.
I want men around me to touch themselves. No, that's not quite it.
But to tie it together, and why I asked the question, as a result of you not coming from a place of being self or needing to be self-reliant, I have never in our 8 years felt more connected to you.
Yeah. And I think that's absolutely true. We've never been more connected. I think the other thing is, I like to think, and I'm not 100% sure of this because I'm still a little bit in it. But I think I'm dealing with the grief as well as I possibly can be.
Oh, you
and,
are.
You know, I think there's still going to be, you know, waves that are going to come. I think there's still going to be triggers that come. However, you know, I think it's the most horrific thing you can go through.
Yeah.
And I've been able to deal with it fairly well.
You have. And I've been amazed by that. And I am so grateful as your partner that you've chosen to stay open and vulnerable and relational at a time where it would have been super, super easy to withdraw and isolate.
To go in the man cave and start drinking myself to death.
Yeah. And, I, you know, I really wanted to highlight that piece of this in the context of this conversation, because it takes a lot of courage to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And we all, men and women, fear vulnerability for fear of rejection. And my guess is we all want to be there for others, but we don't know how. Like tandem, we don't know some of the tools, but we also have these barriers to entry from unresolved wounds that are in the way of feeling that I can be safe and seen and that I can trust my partner to be there for me.
Well, and we also don't want to be embarrassed. We don't want to be embarrassed or shamed for our emotions. And, you know, for the women out there that are listening, please, please, please do your best to accept your partner's feelings without judgment. I've heard too many stories of women manboxing their man where, you know, I've had one guy tell me that his girlfriend told him to stop being a pussy because he was crying. Mm. And, you know, that stuff doesn't help.
Yeah.
Because the one thing that I will guarantee is he's never going to do that again with you.
Yeah.
And if you want close connection, if you want intimacy, if you want vulnerability, that's the fastest way to go in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
So you got to be clear as a woman what you want in a man.
Yeah. Support those behaviors you wish to continue to see, not shut them down. So we are taking both of our lifetime of careers and our individual journeys and personal work that we've done on ourselves combined with our relational work, and are excited that we are going to start offering couples new ways to be able to learn about themselves and cultivate deeper connection, because this whole episode has been about connection. And we've been wanting to do more of this for some time, and it feels that everything has kind of converged for us to truly step into this role of guiding others in cultivating the relationships that they've always wanted. And so one of the ways that we are going to do that, in addition to doing, you know, our ongoing relationship work and coaching that we do with clients, it's really a great model where John works with the men, I work with the women, we come together as the four of us. It's a beautiful way to be able to everyone feel heard and seen and validated while receiving tools in a really supportive environment. So that's ongoing. We do that virtually. So even if you're not near us and want to work with us, that's always a possibility. And of course, we've got our Costa Rica retreat in September. But what we're starting in January is a monthly masterclass series. And we've come up with a framework called the AWARE method. And it's really cultivating skills on how to be more aware of your own self and other, so that you can do your own inner work, so that you can become more available for deeper connection in your relationship. And it's going to be the second Tuesday of each month, a live Zoom call. And we have the link in the show notes. And you can sign up for the whole year, or you can just sign up for the months that seem to be most connected to where you're at, although they're all interconnected. So I would say, Joy, you know, do all of them. But we're really excited to be stepping into this next level of our own relationship guiding and coaching of others. So I hope that our own personal journeys, we're going to be doing a lot more podcast episodes together. But just as you hear our story as an evolution of, we weren't always like this. It's what we both wanted. Mm-hmm. But we have truly done our own inner work and the relational work to have the relationship that we both always wanted and are so proud of. And it's possible. Anyone can learn this.
Yeah, these are tools that everyone can learn.
And we're here to teach you. So I hope that this spoke to you. I hope this resonates. And I hope you join us in this journey of self-awareness, relational awareness, so that you can deepen your connections. Because when you do, my God, life feels so much richer.
That was a most excellent explanation, honey.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. All right. You guys, if this episode spoke to you, we would love a rating, a review, a share, so we can help others journey forward into becoming more evolved cavemen and cavewomen. And again, the monthly masterclass is starting Tuesday, January 9th. The link is in the show notes. Thanks so much for tuning in today. We greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.